Now, my proposition today is that for all the difficulties, the picture across the region has changed a great deal in the last 18 months, and broadly for the better. 2006 was a particularly bad year for the Middle East, a war in the Lebanon, a downward spiral of violence in Iraq, a rejectionist group elected to form a Palestinian government, and Iran defiant on the nuclear file and flexing its muscles regionally. But there have been changes since then, and there is a moment of opportunity now with the international community reuniting around a recognizable common agenda in support of Iraq, on the Middle East peace process, and in Lebanon, and an attempt to put aside some of the enmities and differences of the past few years and develop that agenda together. I would see 2008 as a chance to see forward progress in three areas in particular: to consolidate the success of the military surge in Iraq, and a building international consensus on that subject, to encourage further national political reconciliation in Iraq, and strengthen the Iraqi people's capacity to take responsibility for their security and for their political future. Second, to build on Annapolis and to take major steps this year towards a historic, just, and lasting peace in the Arab-Israeli conflict, in order to give the Palestinian people their own independent state, and to which would lead to a secure Israel accepted by the Arab world. And my third area would be to make our diplomacy on Syria and Iran more vigorous and effective, to bring home to both countries that they face a strategic choice between further defiance of the international community and further sanctions and isolation on one hand, or cooperating with us and securing the political and economic benefits which would follow. Now, Rob, you've mentioned the British role in your trailer for this. Generously described the UK as an important player on the European stage and a critical Middle East partner for the US. Now, from London's perspective, the Middle East is an issue of vital strategic importance as Europe's near neighbour, as a huge trading partner, and a major source of energy, and so on. It's difficult to capture the extent of the interchange between the UK and the Middle East. But I give you a few figures: 120,000 British citizens living in the United Arab Emirates, $7 billion of exports to Saudi Arabia, 25,000 British nationals performing the Hajj each year, and the $200 million sponsorship of Arsenal's football stadium by Emirates Airlines. Now, what that little selection of statistics shows, is that our links are strong, long-lasting, but also very contemporary, and they cross the obvious economic, political, cultural, religious, and other boundaries. I don't want to exaggerate the UK's importance. Our ability to act alone is very limited. It's our relationships with our European partners, with the United States, our membership of the Security Council, and those historical relationships with many of the key players in the region, Arabs, Israelis, Persians, Kurds, that gives us the influence which we try to use. Now, I want to focus on four of the issues for 2008. First of all, Iraq, where the situation is more positive than I imagine most of us in this room could have imagined a year or so ago. Iraqis are increasingly taking responsibility for their affairs. The surge has had a real military impact. The levels of violence across the country have dropped 60% in the past 6 months. And what we see in Al-Anbar, with Al-Qaeda on the back foot for the first time in several years, and Iraqi ownership of the process which has developed there, that is a very encouraging feature of the present scene. Meanwhile, Iraqi security forces continue to develop, and the international community, the EU, the UN, individual countries are becoming more involved. And we particularly welcome the regional dimension to this with the November Istanbul meeting last year, highlighting a more positive approach by Iraq's neighbors. Now, of course, I must say here there's an enormous way to go, but the passage of the de-Ba'athification law over the weekend was certainly welcomed by our government, and we now need more activities aimed at reconciliation at the national level, while being conscious of the practical and political constraints that the Maliki government will continue to operate under. One important priority for 2008 in the UK government's view will be to see provincial elections, which will help empower emerging leaderships there and reinforce the bottom-up developments which we see at work throughout the country. Now, as the British ambassador here, I spend some of my time explaining and sometimes correcting misconceptions about the British role in the south of Iraq. Now, Iraq remains one of our government's top priorities. We still have about 4,500 troops in Iraq. Our role has evolved over the last year as the Iraqi political and security capabilities have developed. And Basra became the last of the four provinces in the southeast to move to Iraqi provincial control in December, bringing to 9 out of 18 the number of provinces which are under Iraqi control. As we look back to 2007, in July of last year, we were taking around 200 hits a week at the Basra Palace complex and at the air station. Today, having withdrawn from the palace complex and consolidated at the air station, today we're taking less than 5 a week. So the situation in terms of violence in Basra has changed markedly for the better. Our troops remain along with our allies, but their role has been modified to that of overwatch. We remain ready to re-intervene to assist the Iraqis if requested, but our troops are routinely involved in training and mentoring of the Iraqi army and police, policing of the Iran-Iraq border, and protection of the supply routes. In the south, we've already trained about 30,000 members of the Iraq security forces, and that training will continue. If the security situation remains stable, then we hope to be able to move to around 2,500 troops in the spring of this year, with a further 500 or so based in Kuwait, and decisions on what to do after 2008 have yet to be taken. Now, a significant proportion of our effort is devoted to the other strands of activity, particularly economic. In the long term, Basra's successful future depends on creating jobs, economic prosperity, and income for its citizens. And that's why we've pushed forward the Basra Investment Promotion Agency to promote the city as an investment location, the Basra Development Fund, and the Development Commission over the past few months. Now, the south is potentially a very rich part of Iraq, so we need to find ways of helping the Iraqis to tap that wealth. On the Middle East peace process, the UK will on this do all we can, both bilaterally and as part of the European Union, to support the parties and reinforce the momentum generated by the Annapolis and Paris conferences and President Bush's visit to the region. The long-standing British view, and you're all familiar with it, is that progress on the Middle East peace process is central to our long-term interests and to forging a moderate coalition in the region and globally. Israeli security is fundamental to a just solution, and so is the alleviation of Palestinian hardship. Both can only be tackled through a political process that creates an economically and socially viable Palestinian state at peace with Israel. So our approach is, first of all, to give all our support to a two-state solution, to give support to those in the region who are committed to peaceful progress, and to promote the economic and social development in the occupied Palestinian territories, which Rob was talking about earlier as an important element in all this. Bilaterally, on the economic and social side, we're focusing on a few areas, in particular building up Palestinian institutions in support of what Tony Blair is doing, and we're ensuring a step change in financial support to the Palestinians. We pledged $500 million of support over 3 years at the December Paris conference. We look forward to working closely with Arab states on an Arab economic initiative and to encouraging greater engagement with Israel, all in line with the Arab Peace Initiative. I'd like to just mention that we see security sector reform as a key area where the UK has an expertise and can add some value. President Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad are committed to this process, and the UK is supporting them through the European Union Civil Police Mission and by providing equipment bilaterally for the Palestinian police by providing, I see, over £1.2 million in contribution to that. And we're also supporting General Dayton's team by providing our own security advisors, including our own general, to add to the three that the Americans have now, your country has now deployed. So you've got a British general, General Deverell, there as well. The Blair mission is another dimension, and we believe a very visible one, of the way in which the UK is trying to help. Prosperity for the Palestinian private sector needs reform driven by the public sector, and that's where Prime Minister Fayyad's reform and development plan comes in. We support it and its emphasis on clean, accountable government and responsible budgeting. But Palestinians need to be given the freedom to work and to reap the benefits of commerce if that plan is to bear fruit. And that's where Tony Blair's role is vital, and we, the UK government, look forward to sponsoring a conference to promote investment in Bethlehem later this year, and we've offered London as the venue. We are worried about what's going on in Gaza. The Gaza Strip will be an integral part of the future Palestinian state. The rocket fire from Gaza into Israel by extremist groups is a reminder, sadly, often daily, of the dangers which Israel faces. But we are worried about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. The humanitarian needs of people who are in no way associated with those rockets attacks should not be compromised. Obviously, Israel's in a difficult position. We welcome the recent decision to increase the supply of industrial diesel, but we continue to urge the Israeli government to lift all its fuel restrictions. Now, as we look to the next year, we all know that because of history, both sides are fearful of making the compromises which will be necessary to reach a settlement. But after several years of stagnation, with the start of the Annapolis process, the framework that was provided during the president's visit over the last few days, and yesterday's meeting between the two negotiating teams reportedly discussing final status issues, we do feel that's welcome news and should be built on during the year. I'd like to move now just to talk a little bit about Syria and Lebanon. As some of you know, about a year ago, I visited Damascus on our Prime Minister's behalf to explain that the UK was interested in a better relationship with Syria, conditional, obviously, on improvements in the regime's behaviour. And I was one of a number of European and other visitors trying to persuade President Assad at that stage that there was a choice. Sadly, we didn't succeed in persuading him at that stage, and there hasn't been a vast amount of encouraging news for Syria watchers in recent times. But the good news for Damascus is that that offer remains on the table, as was reflected in their place at Annapolis. We remain keen to see Syria play a constructive regional role, and the prospects for greater diplomatic and economic engagement remain, but not at the price of Lebanon's sovereignty, not at the price of the integrity of the Middle East peace process or Iraq's stability. And probably the most urgent choice for Syria today is over its role in relation to Lebanon, where we strongly support the US and French-led efforts to get a new president and a new government installed as soon as possible. And while I'm on that subject, I should obviously make clear how much we condemn today's attack on a US convoy and deeply regret the loss of life and the injuries to your and local citizens. Let me conclude with some words on Iran, which I know is a subject of debate in this institute as elsewhere in Washington. Iran remains one of our toughest and most complex foreign policy challenges, and it's going to remain that way for some time. The UK and US analysis, both of the problem and the prescription, remain close. with shared concerns about Iran's regional muscle flexing and support for militant groups in Iraq, Lebanon, and elsewhere, as well as its appalling human rights record. As for the NIE, we made clear immediately that it didn't change what we saw as the rationale for our twin-track approach. Our concerns were, after all, about the nature of the Iranian program, and in particular their determination to develop enrichment and heavy water reprocessing capabilities, which would give them the capability to develop fissile material, and the fact that Iran deliberately concealed these activities over a period of time. Now, those concerns remain and are made worse by Iran's refusal to comply with legally binding Security Council resolutions. So the basis for our twin-track approach remains. Iran's pluralistic system of government, its relatively open society, its desire for respectability and legitimacy, that all gives us levers that we can exploit. Some in the regime worry that the price of the course they are on is too high. Others are interested in a different sort of relationship with the international community and the commercial and other benefits that would flow from that. And we've got some important landmarks, political landmarks, over the next 18 months, including the Majlis elections in March of this year and presidential elections in spring of 2009. In policy terms, these are useful to us, and we need to continue to sharpen the choice for Iran in the meantime. Sharpening the choice in the short run means increasing the price. And the next step is to take forward discussions on a new Security Council resolution, adoption of which would send an important signal to Iran after the NIE that Iran is definitely not off the hook internationally. Now, intense work on that continues. European leaders agreed in December that once the SCR was adopted, the European Union would look at complementary European measures of the sort we applied in April of last year, when we sanctioned 24 Iranian entities and individuals going beyond the Security Council resolution. We imposed an embargo on the export of dual-use goods, and interpreted the travel restrictions in the Security Council resolution as a legally binding ban. So I would expect a European Union package to follow any further action in the Security Council. We in the UK see the combination of international political unity on the one hand and economic sanctions on the other as having real bite. The financial sector in Iran is suffering from sanctions, and businessmen are finding it increasingly difficult to do business. Many European banks have stopped dealing with Iran. From the end of December, Iranian banks no longer had access to clearance in sterling. Within Iran, we see increasing noise levels about the economy and increasing nervousness within the regime and society at large, both about the impact of sanctions and the impact of further sanctions. So we need to exploit all those things. But while increasing the pressure is important, we must not neglect the other strand of our policy. And that means continuing to hold out the offer of a new relationship if Iran modifies its policies. The package that the E3+3 put to Iran in 2006 with US support remains on the table. And it's worth reminding ourselves that it would give Iran everything it needs to develop a state-of-the-art civil nuclear power industry, including cooperation in developing power reactors and legally guaranteed supplies of nuclear fuel. And it also offers significant political and economic benefits, including a trade and cooperation agreement with the European Union and a strategic energy partnership with the EU, and the lifting of sanctions in areas critical to the Iranian economy. And added to all that, there was the prospect of an opportunity to discuss regional security issues with the six as a whole, including the United States. So that was the offer on the table. As we go forward, we will need to be creative, using a combination of dialogue, direct engagement, and pressure to persuade Iran to change their behavior. And the UK, with an embassy of its own in Iran, has a different set of tools from the United States, but the fact that the Europeans and Americans are cooperating so closely on this issue really does strengthen our hand. I'll leave it there, Rob, and look forward to taking your questions. Thank you very much indeed.